stealing in as relapse sums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode. Nope.
Use that shiny.
Hello and welcome to episode 61 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. In snowy Somerville, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me is Andrew Brokus. How are you?
I'm excellent. And yourself?
Fantastic. Couldn't be better. It's been a great year.
Yes. I was going to say I should wish you a preemptive Happy New Year and all of our listeners as well.
Absolutely. Been a fantastic year. It's been our second partial year, or complete year of doing the podcast. Still going strong. Still very grateful for everybody who's taken time this year to thoughtfully listen to the podcast. It's been great. So thanks to all the listeners and thanks to you.
Yeah, and grateful as well to all the people who have come on the show. I mean, I think we've had an incredibly high success rate of just, you know, asking people, in many cases, people who had no idea who we were prior to us contacting them, and people being very gracious, not just about coming on the show, but, you know, really being open, talking about a lot of things in their lives and a lot of subjects that maybe would be worth some money to them in terms of poker strategy or, I just think people have been very open and forthcoming, and we're grateful to them for that, and I imagine that our listeners are as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know how at the end of a movie sometimes, you know, you see all these movie actors doing outtakes, you know, there's all this extra material that they have, and it's given to it's given to the viewers of the movie as a treat. Well, this episode's got something like that in the Thinking Poker style, doesn't it?
Yeah, if some of you might remember when we did episode 50 with an actor named Keone Young, who's also a poker player. We explained in that episode that we actually interviewed Keone twice, and this was thanks to a failure on my part and also a technical failure. Generally, we record these episodes using two different programs so as to minimize the risk of losing footage entirely. And this is the only time since we've been recording with two different programs, we've managed to have two different failures. But our one program that just kind of records our calls automatically, for whatever reason, didn't do that. And I failed to press record on the other of the programs that needed to be started manually for about 20 minutes into that interview. So we had a great one-hour interview with Keone. We lost 20 minutes of it. And we were fully ready to use the remaining 40 minutes and just talk to Keone for another 15 minutes or so and fill in the blanks from that were lost. So we talked to Keone again, and he's such a charismatic, friendly, interesting guy that we ended up talking to him for an hour when we were supposed to talk to him for 15 minutes. So we cut together those two interviews, but we didn't use terribly much from the first interview. The second one, the sound quality was a little bit better, and we just ended up mostly using stuff from the second of the two interviews. And we figured we'd hold that first interview in the pocket for some time when we didn't have, and we didn't otherwise have a guest for the show. And guess what? That's this week. So you're going to be hearing some outtakes from the Keone Young interview. It's all interesting stuff, I think. It's not going to sound exactly like one of our regular interviews because it'll jump around a little bit in terms of content, but I don't think it'll be difficult to follow. It'll probably make a little bit more sense for those of you who have listened to episode 50 and already heard Keone's full story, but in case you don't care to do that, I think it'll still make plenty of sense. And the important things to know about him are that he is he's an actor, a very prolific Asian-American character actor who's been on a really wide variety of syndicated television shows. I think some of his most famous appearances have been on Sons of Anarchy, True Blood. I knew him as Mr. Wu from Deadwood. He was also in Men in Black 3 with Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. He's he does a lot of voice acting as well. So he was in the 1980s G.I. Joe cartoons, The Simpsons, American Dad, Family Guy, a lot of animated movies. Basically anything involving voice acting, there's a decent chance Keone's been on there at some point. So Yeah, that's basically all you need to know about him. And he's interested in poker, and you'll hear some more stories from Keone. And hopefully, if you haven't already listened to episode 50, hearing Keone and what an interesting guy he is on this episode will prompt you to go back and get his full story from episode 50.
Yeah, he's great. He's a listener, he's a commenter, he's a guest, and a friend of the show. Great guy. And some of our listeners have asked for outtakes before, so they're getting these outtakes, and they've said that they want this because they just can't get enough of the show. And for those listeners who really, truly are not just being nice, but actually want more content from Andrew and from me, there's a way to do that now. Martin Harris, who was one of our very first guests, possibly show number 2, I think.
No, it was that early. I want to say 7.
Oh, no, I think it was 5.
Five is plausible.
Yeah, I think it was a single-digit prime number. 1 second. That's all right, so I was wrong. It was episode 4 with Martin Harris, and he is a very interesting guy in his own right. He's a college teacher. He's a thoughtful observer of poker and of American culture generally. He's also involved in poker news. He's one of the really... one of the very best of really a very talented group of people Poker News has, and I think his work is great. He's doing something called Learn Poker News, learn.pokernews.com, and it's a bunch of articles and possibly other resources too for beginning players. I've contributed one article already, and I'm going to contribute more, and I think Andrew's going to throw in an article every now and then.
That's the idea.
Yeah. And you can read our articles there if you want to.
Yeah. And Nate, part of why I jokingly say that is just that I do a lot of writing, and sometimes it's tricky to come up. Like sometimes I'm already stretching to come up with topics for my other commitments. Although I think the fact that this one is targeted towards a slightly different audience, like usually when I'm writing for 2+2, especially I'm kind of trying to put something out there that people haven't seen before. And this is more, I think, kind of explaining some simpler concepts for people who are new to the game. So I don't think it'll actually compete that much with my other writing responsibilities. But the other reason I hesitate here is that, Nate, you have set the bar very high for for following up on these articles. The first one of these that you wrote, titled 7 Attention Targets for Beginning Poker Players. Was that your title, by the way, or did...
No. I mean, but they have to do that for SEO and things like that, and people like lists also.
Yeah.
My original title was What to Pay Attention To, but Martin, professional in a lot of ways, he gave me discretion in this, so it's not like, you know, he wielded some editorial hammer and changed it on me. We had a thoughtful discussion, and I agreed that for the purposes of search engine optimization and reader friendliness, that a different kind of title would be acceptable. It's absolutely fine. What's it called? 7 Attention Targets for Beginning Poker Players?
Or yeah, something? The list format didn't really seem like your style, or the kind of BuzzFeed sort of 7X, 10Y.
Yeah, but I mean, it was written that way. He didn't change anything about that. So it was meant to be some prose, and then a list, and then some other prose. So that's absolutely authentic. And I mean, Martin's a really great editor, not only because he's so smart and thoughtful, but also he's not one of these tyrant editors. anyway, I've written for a lot of people, and it's just nice to write for somebody like Martin. So, no, the title is not mine. The article is mine. I applaud the effort that Poker News is making here, and you'll see more from me. We ought to see more from Andrew, and you're very kind. Thank you for saying such nice things.
Well, really, I mean, like I said about, I was kind of thinking this would just be sort of maybe well-trod or well-known bits of poker advice explained. I mean, I think you and I are better equipped than a lot of people who write these sorts of articles to explain things to beginning poker players. But there was at least one of your 7 things to pay attention to that was not something that I had explicitly thought about before. And I wouldn't generally open an article like this expecting to come across something I hadn't thought of before. So I think that that you have really set the bar high here, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to live up to your standards, sir.
Yeah. Well, you're very kind. In some sense, David Sklansky was an inspiration here because, I mean, tournament poker for advanced poker players was for advanced poker players, but it wasn't necessarily for advanced tournament players or experienced tournament players. So a lot of the advice there was very basic, but that didn't mean that it had to be, you know, just simple or just sort of simple versions of what was already out there. I mean, the distinction between advice for beginners and advice for non-beginners is not the same as the distinction between simple advice and advanced advice. It's just advice for beginners. And I mean, that's not to say that I won't write anything that's just simple versions of more complicated concepts or possibly even some non-strategy articles also I'll be contributing. But, you know, I mean, if the podcast also has taught me anything, it's that there are all sorts of incredibly thoughtful and interesting people who happen to be beginning poker players. Right. And there's no reason to necessarily keep everything simple. That said, it's not that there's any rocket science in that article. It's just a different kind of thing. And it was really fun to write. So
learn.pokernews.com, you can find that article. I'll put up a link to that specific article in the show notes. But from time to time, you will find other articles from Nate and myself on there. And I'll try to remember to plug those on the blog and on Twitter when they come out. But the best way to find them is just to check out learn.pokernews.com. And you can support one of our early podcast guests by doing that as well.
Excellent. Shall we do some strategy?
Yes.
Snow shovel guy thinks we shouldn't do some strategy right now.
I'm always going on about the vibrant learning community over at Tournament Poker Edge, and this week I've got some examples of that to share with you. First off, if you're a regular listener to the show, then you know that our friend Carlos is working on a transition from MTTs that have been his bread and butter since he began taking poker seriously to playing cash games, and specifically live cash games. So he started a thread on Tournament Poker Edge where he posts cash hands, and he's getting feedback from other TPE members, either those who are interested in cash play themselves already or who maybe are interested in making the sort of transition that Carlos is, and people can follow along a bit with his improvement over there. And he's also getting feedback from some of the pros, or from myself anyway. I'm not sure if others have commented yet. There's also talk on Tournament Poker Edge of starting a thread that would be dedicated to practicing the simplified hand reading technique that I advocate in my hand reading series there. And you've probably heard me discuss at least a bit on the show, or if you've read some of the things I've written about hand reading, you may have come across this before. But there's kind of a community of people there who are interested in practicing it and just kind of in posting hands where they go through examples of applying this and give each other feedback. And if that does get started, I'll intend to be an active participant there as well, which I think goes to show you how much being a part of a learning community, as opposed to just watching videos or reading poker books by yourself, can really enhance your growth as a player. And you can join that community by signing up for tournamentpokeredge.com.
So our strategy today comes from Australia. It makes me feel a little bit guilty because John Bredon was only willing to talk to us, or he claimed that he was partly willing to talk to us in part because we have no listeners in Australia. but this hand comes from Adelaide, so Australian strategy today. The hand comes from Mike, who's playing a local $2,500 tournament with the top 10 players getting paid and all getting a ticket to a local $25,000 tournament, which would be a big boost to the bankroll. And there are 180 odd runners. And first, I already have some things to say about this because it looks like the prize is 10 times the buy-in. But the prize is only being given to one out of every 18 runners.
I'm wondering now, looking at the grammar of this, though, he says the top 10 players get paid and get a ticket to a local $25,000 tournament. So I wonder if there's not some sort of cash prize in addition to the season.
Okay, that makes sense.
Because, yes, the math does not check out if there are 180 runners and only 10 seats.
That's right. So, I mean, it makes a bit of a difference to the strategy. I've been thinking about this hand as if it's a satellite hand, but there are some other cash prizes too, probably. That said, unless they're adding tens of thousands of dollars to the prize pool, which I'm just going to go out of limb and say that they aren't, it's functionally similar to a satellite. I mean, of course, getting first place is significantly better than getting 10th place, but when
So you already have pretty flat playouts most of the time when like 60% of the prize pool, or maybe even more depending on what the rake is an additional flat payout to everyone, then that certainly makes the tournament play a lot like a satellite.
Basically, the difference between getting 11th versus 10th is tremendous, and the difference between getting 10th versus 9th or even 10th versus 1st may not be so large, yeah. In which case locking up 10th place is a lot more important than increasing your chance of winning 1st place, which might otherwise be your goal in a normal MTT.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're at the 300-600 blind level. There are no antes, which is pretty interesting, actually, and significant. Under the Gun has a 4,400 stack. So it was playing with 7 1/3 big blinds and moves all in. Mike is in the cutoff with 24,000. So he has some observations so far. They've been playing close to an hour. The villain one is loose aggressive. This is the guy who moved all in. He's raising a lot of pots pre-flop, c-betting and check folding the turn. Mike has won a couple of pots off him without going to showdown, calling his preflop raise and c-bet, and then raising the turn when he checks it, or just betting the turn when he checks it. Villain two in the small blind, and spoiler alert, this is relevant, is sitting next to her partner at the table. They're buying drinks and they're very talkative. She's built her stack with a couple of showdown wins, showing top pairs, etc. And he thinks his own image, good thing to be thinking about Mike, is tight but aggressive. He's won a few pots without having to show down with continuation bets, both on the flop and turn, having raised before the flop. And he hasn't done anything out of line. Well, that's interesting. But it's possible he was a little bit out of line with some of those following through on the turn. But, okay, so good reads. Again, the under the gun plus one player shoved 4,400. It folded around to Mike with ace king offsuit, and Mike called. I don't want to belabor this too much. I think shoving here is clearly correct.
Interesting. And do you think that's specific to the satellite comparison here?
I think it's partly because of the satellite comparison, partly because we have a loose aggressive player who's just shoved 7 1/3 big blinds from under the gun plus one, and even a pot-sized raise would be the majority of Mike's stack anyway.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't raise less than all in. I guess my inclination here would be to call, actually.
Really? Why is that?
I think the raise is large enough that I don't think even the big blind is not going to be getting like such amazing odds to just like take a flop for no reason. Basically, okay. I think that a raise doesn't do that much to price out people from just, you know, randomly calling with some hand you might prefer that they fold.
Yeah.
It might, however, entice them to call with hands that you would like them to call with, which is fine. I mean, I don't think any good tournament player is going to like overcall this all that liberally, but you know, it sounds like this field might have some players in it who will make a call for 4,400 that they probably shouldn't. I mean, you have a hand like ace king. There's a lot of hands like that where you might get people coming in with ace 10 or king 10 or something that they're not going to call if you shove, but they might call. And I guess the downside of that is whether you're going to entice people to come in with pocket pairs, which are hands that you would prefer them to fold. And maybe there's a little bit of tension here between my two comments, but I think that calling 4,400 shows sufficient strength that I don't think people should just be kind of arbitrarily shipping over it. And if they are, they're certainly going to make a mistake against your range, even if not against your exact hand. But like, I don't see any reason why I would play aces any differently than this. And I also don't see why I wouldn't necessarily call here with ace-jack planning on folding to a shove. I think I'd rather just have a single calling range here rather than shoving some hands and then also trying to have a call folding range and a call calling range.
Yeah, so given the description of the table, I'm not too worried about being balanced here. I am happy to shove with hands that I really want to shove with, and I really want to get those pocket pairs out, and I think that in a lot of situations, they're going to call down to pocket fours and fives in the small and big blind, and that's really bad. I mean, maybe you can fold some of those hands on the flop. It's not all bad, but you're going to have to invest more money to do that, and in a dry side pot, you might be more inclined to play passively. Spoiler alert. and ace king is just wonderful to take, you know, to isolate with in this spot. I think I like a shove, largely because of the satellite dynamics. I do think you miss out against ace 10 type hands or king queen type hands, but even those might fold sometimes. And if he's calling with those, you might call with other hands you don't want him to call with. I I'm a little bit embarrassed because I made this confident claim and I don't have the math off the top of my head to back it up. But in a situation like this, I really just want to move all in and maximize my chances of winning the pot. I think that some of the dry side pot dynamics are not going to be especially favorable for Ace-King after the flop. So you won't have the playing advantages that you might have in other situations. And winning the pot is great. Winning the pot in this situation is really great.
Yeah, I think you make a pretty strong case here. In a non-satellite circumstance, I would be more inclined to call. Yeah. I do think, though, that and we don't actually have information on how many players remain in this tournament, which could be a little bit relevant. But yeah, I think the more that you're taking, the more that you're really prioritizing your survival and kind of picking up a fair number of chips with minimal risk rather than increasing your risk and also trying to increase the size of the pot that you might win, to the extent that those are concerns, I think the decision is sufficiently close between calling and shoving that I could easily see myself swinging towards shoving because of even some kind of minor satellite considerations.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially if your opposition is a little bit better and if the pay structure is different, then I really do love calling. And I love having one calling range with aces, with ace king, with ace jack, with possibly like queen jack suited. Like if he's really shoving loose under the gun, then queen jack suited's in fine shape. It's going to play fine in position. You have plenty of protection in your range in case somebody decides to get frisky and shove. They're still making a big mistake if they're doing that too wide against your range. So even a hand like queen jack suited, I think is not like a fist pump call, but I think it's a clear call. I'm not sure what the bottom of my range is. I'm starting to think that's close. Maybe like queen jack offsuit. Close. Yeah. What's the bottom of your range for calling?
It might actually be queen jack suited. I don't know about, because we're only in the cutoff here. There are still three players who could wake up behind us with hands.
Yeah.
If I'm in the big blind, I'm certainly calling with queen jack offsuit. Maybe even the button. Probably the button.
Yeah.
But yeah. I think cutoff. I would probably be inclined to let go of that.
Yeah. Wait. What do you do if you're in the big blind with jack eight suited?
Yeah, I guess probably is a call.
Yeah, I mean, that's
yeah, I was pretty quick to correct myself.
Sorry. I mean, there's no ante. It makes a big difference. No ante.
Yeah, but still. Unless we have a reason to think that this guy is shoving like a stupidly tight range, which it sounds like, if anything, his range might be wider than it should be. So, yeah, it seems like you ought to have a pretty wide calling range out of the big blind.
It's not so easy to shove wider than you should be here. It takes some doing, but yeah. Okay, so what I thought was obvious is not obvious. Always an improvement when you come to realize that that fewer things are obvious. And we get to the flop. Oh, sorry. The small blind calls behind. So there's 14,100 in the pot. And Mike thinks so far that he's really not concerned about villain one's shoving range in this spot. He thinks it's very wide and that Mike's ace-king offsuit is well ahead of his range. That's okay. At the time, I was not overly concerned about those remaining left to act. The button and the small blind were preoccupied, organizing their drinks and generally chatting, whilst the big blind was a nit and not playing any hands. When the small blind calls, I think her range is very wide. Up to 30% of hands she could be playing in this spot. She's relatively deep with regards to her stack, so I have no doubt that I'm ahead of her range and I'm in position. So two things. One, there's a slight tension between two things that Mike says here. Like, not that you can't make them consistent, but if she's so preoccupied, you know, with her drinks and everything, well, she's not too preoccupied to play 30% of her hands. It may be that she's too preoccupied to make like expert squeeze plays, but I don't know if that's a great inference. The second is just that if they've been playing for only an hour, you don't always have great evidence that the big blind really is tight. And even like live player tight, I mean, what's he going to do with ace jack or sevens? Like how tight is he? You know, I mean, you might not have seen him play for an hour, but I would want to know more about how you're grounding this belief that the big blind is tight and exactly what you think that means. Like, it's really important. Sometimes tight players will be more likely to make a squeeze play here. You know, like, I mean, this is a standard thing. It was uncommon 10 years ago, but it's common now. I'm going to play tight for an hour. I'm going to find a spot and then I'm going to move all in, you know, and you could think, weak raiser, weak caller. I move all in. You know, this is something that a lot of people do and even people who you wouldn't expect it of. So, I think that Mike's off to a good start here thinking about his opponents. I have some next questions. If I would, you know, if he were here, I would have more questions for him about why he thinks what he does and what exactly he takes the consequences of his reads to be.
Agreed.
So the flop comes three-handed. Small blind, who again has 35,000, had 35,000 to start the hand, has like 27,000 behind now. Yeah, three-handed, small blind, the all-in shover and Mike. The flop is ace, queen, 10, rainbow. And the small blind checks. Mike says he thinks he has the best hand a lot in this spot, given the two villains' pre-flop ranges, and he proceeds to bet 6,200 into the 14,100 pot, leaving him with 17,800 behind.
So classic leap in conclusion here, to go from, I think I have the best hand, therefore I bet.
Yeah.
So, you know, the important thing about betting is that you have to not only have the best hand right now, you have to have the best hand after further money goes into the pot to want to bet.
Usually.
And I mean, this is, in fact, quite a large pot. There might be some case for betting simply to lock up your equity. But generally speaking, you know, just because you believe you have the best hand, you also want to think about, am I still likely to have the best hand if I get further action? What kind of action am I likely to get from what? We've talked a lot on the show before about the importance of having a value target in mind, knowing what am I trying to get action from when I bet.
And especially in a dry side pot, you often lose one of the other reasons that you can have to bet, which is that the money, if you check, the money's going to go in anyway because the other person's going to bet and you have to call, say, and the money goes in better if you bet. I'm not sure that that reason applies, you know, here for many reasons. But in a case with a dry side pot, and ace king on an ace queen 10 board, I don't think that these other reasons for betting apply either.
Yeah, I mean, people generally expect, and not entirely without reason, that you are going to play pretty straightforwardly in a dry side pot. You know, if you had, for instance, 6-5 of spades here, there wouldn't be a lot of sense in betting the flop because you're still probably not going to beat the all-in player. So all you're really doing, I mean, you're kind of bluffing at nothing. You know, you're risking money in the event that small blind calls you, and you have very little to gain because your odds of beating under the gun when you're holding 6-5 and this is the flop are pretty slim. So, and I think even not particularly sophisticated players kind of get this concept. In fact, not particularly sophisticated players probably overstate the extent to which you should be passive in a dry side pot.
Yeah.
But I think that betting here, unlike, you know, betting in a more normal situation, betting on this flop, people really aren't going to expect you to be doing it with less than an ace, and certainly not as a bluff.
I think that's right. I certainly would do it with less than an ace, but I wouldn't do it with a dead hand like six high. Yeah. If I had jack 10, I can see a lot of reasons for making a small bet. I think my bet size would be small with my whole range. Right. I think I'm unlikely to be raised except by a very good hand. Spoiler alert. you know, I mean, it might build the pot a little bit if I hit my straight. I could fold out even a hand like jacks sometimes, or even a hand like queen 9, which is wonderful. I've got good equity against the all-in player. I see a lot of reasons to bet with a hand like jack 10, even though that might be a little bit thin, especially for a very small size if I think that my opponent is never going to get out of line. But I think that my opponents would not expect me to bet with less than an ace, which is one reason why I like betting with jack 10. And I think that certainly pure bluffs are really not called for here. There's just no reason for it.
What follows from that then is that your opponent is not particularly likely to give you action with a hand that can't beat an ace.
Yeah.
So when you bet, certainly your opponent, I'm not expecting that your opponent is going to fold an ace if she has one, but I actually think it's realistic, just as you were saying, Nate, that someone might let go of jacks or queen nine, especially to a pretty strong looking bet here.
Yeah.
I think that betting with ace king, there really aren't a ton of second best hands that can give you action. And the hands that will give you action, like a dominated ace, you don't have to bet the flop to get action from those hands, right?
Right.
You know, the ace is still going to be the top pair on the turn.
Yep.
Most turns are not going to be especially scary for an ace. Some will, but some of those also improve your hand, so that's not the end of the world. I think that your prospects for getting value from dominated aces are nearly as good on the turn as they are on the flop, and you're going to get more information about whether you actually have the best hand, and your prospects, once the flop checks through, of getting action from jacks or queen nine, I think improve considerably. So overall, I think you're in better shape if your bet goes in on future streets than if it goes in on the flop.
Yeah, and I also want to talk about the bet size here. I think 6,200 is too large, partly because the hands, because the bet makes sense really only if you're targeting hands like queen jack. I mean, a lot of hands with queens in them or tens with them will also have gut shots, so that'll make it a little bit easier to get action from them. But you need to be targeting some weaker hands. And here's a good way to think about dry side pots. So the pot is 14,100 and the all-in player has some equity in the pot. So pretend that you don't know what your own hand is and just think about, you know, range against range against range. How much of the equity does the all-in player have? And you can estimate maybe 25%, 20%, 25%.
25 is the number I was going to throw.
Yeah, so maybe 3,000, you know, just in the heat of battle. Let's just say that 3,000 of that pot belongs to the all-in player. So you and the other player are fighting for 11,100, let's just say. Now, 6,200 into 11,100, that's a big bet. Especially in a tournament, especially with these stack sizes, it's just a really large bet. And as we've been talking about, even more so given what you need to be targeting, which is a lot of hands. So I think a much smaller bet is really called for here. I would probably bet 3,700.
If I were going to bet at all, I like that size.
Yeah, I would actually bet zero, but my betting range, I think, you know, if I needed to construct one bet size for my whole range, it would be small. And in fact, with this hand, I would bet very small. And with Jack 10, I would also bet very small.
Yeah, so this is like a third of what you're considering to be the effective pot.
That's right.
The effective pot is 11K, we're betting 3,700. That's maybe a touch over a third of the pot.
Yeah, that's right.
That seems right to me.
That's right. And notice that that's still... threatens not her stack, she covers you, but it threatens her into paying off your whole stack. I mean, you only had 24,000 to start the hand, you have 17,000 left, 3,000, it's healthy in relation to the effective pot. And it also, I mean, you're betting three of your last 17,000. It's not hard to get the rest of it in by the turn and river. Like, she's got to think about, you know, one thing that Andrew and I, well, Andrew more eloquently usually talks about is putting the whole stack in play and, you know, either threatening a stack or threatening to pay off your whole stack. And a really small bet in the 3,000 range does that.
And this is one reason why you might get better action on later streets is that the leverage effect isn't quite the same.
Yeah.
You know, if even if you just bet a third of the pot on the flop, a third of the pot on the turn, you can still shove the river and not be betting more than half the pot at that point.
Yeah.
So even a small bet right now has a pretty strong leverage effect, which you don't want when you have a hand like this, which is probably best, but you're wondering, you know, just how many second best hands are going to pay off. You really want to minimize that leverage effect.
Yeah.
And the last thing to consider is that getting shoved on here sucks.
Yep.
And it's going to happen a lot when you bet a third of your stack.
Yeah.
A lot of people aren't just going to call for that amount. They're going to shove or fold.
That's right.
So another reason, like you were talking about, Nate, you can bet Jack 10 just saying, well, I'll fold if they ship on me.
Right.
And, you know, with Ace King, you really, really don't want to do that. There's an outside chance she's shoving with worse.
Yeah.
Just because she has some ace and she's like, this pot is pretty big. I better just put it in. And then even if she does have a better hand, like, you have decent equity against Ace Queen. You know, you don't. I mean, it's a clear fold if you know she has ace queen, but at the same time, seeing another card would be awfully nice.
It'd be great, yeah.
And all you have to do is tap the table and you get to see that next card.
True. Small blind does shove.
Yep.
So, you know, sad trombone. And Mike calls the bet. He says he calls with little hesitation. I think not hesitating is poor here. I think you got to be thinking about this for all these reasons. Actually, I think a fold is possibly recommended.
Yeah, it's such a nasty spot because you're getting awfully good odds. And I guess the key question I'm going to ask myself is, how likely do I think it is that she's seeing the flop with some random ace? And yeah, if she did, how likely do I think it is that she's shoving?
Yeah.
And I mean, this sounds like the kind of player who just might do that with it. And I mean, folding is obviously such a disaster if she doesn't have ace six. But at the same time, I have a really awful feeling about this, given everything I was saying about getting action in dry side pots.
And some of these aces do have gut shots, so I think ace king, ace jack, a hand like that could do that. Also, sometimes when people trap with kings and jacks, and like there's first the agony shove when they get the when the ace comes. Also, in my own head, the Raymond Rami, Rame, how do you pronounce his name? The guy from South Africa.
Yeah, I know he. Yeah. I'm not sure. Anything.
Yeah, the sad face Raymond shove, but like, and especially when they have a gut shot, they can think that they have equity. So I do think that the small blind can be shoving with worse. I don't like it, but given the equity that we have, I'm going to call here, sadly,
I hate being in this spot.
And when we have all the other reasons not to bet the flop in the first place, of course, the whole reason that being in this spot is bad is that it doesn't happen often. So in some sense, it's not the best reason not to bet the flop. I think the other reasons not to bet the flop are much more important, because worrying about low probability tough spots is often, like, when the spot is tough because it rarely happens, then that's often a reason not to care about it very much and to let it not let it influence your thinking very much. This is something I've said probably at least 300 times in my poker career in strategy conversations. Like, it's like, oh, what'll I do if I get 4-bet? It's like, well, it's only tough because it's never going to happen, right? So why don't you just do the fundamentally sound thing and then worry about that later? Yeah, so I think checking the flop is something that you should do, and I think that you should think it through a bit more before you call. I would call. Andrew's a little bit more on the fence.
No, I mean, I would call. I just want to emphasize.
It sucks.
The situation I'm in.
And the small blind had the nuts, and Mike didn't suck out for the chop or the unlikely win. That's...
Sorry, Mike.
Yeah. Yeah, but thanks for sending in the hand. The excellent choice to email podcast@thinkingpoker.net with your strategy hands. That was an excellent choice.
And thanks for contributing to our listening base down under.
It's very hard to lie with a sound. If am I making myself? Is there some logic to what I'm saying?
Yeah, but, absolutely.
Can you say a little bit more about that point? It's hard to lie with a sound.
Well, you know how animals don't talk to each other. They communicate through sound. They communicate through look, and the sounds that you emit from whatever part of your, from whatever orifice of your body, bears a lot of detail in terms of how you are really thinking and how you are feeling. A slight sigh, a slight hiss, a slight intake of the breath. And that's why in Chinese language and in any Asian language, we use a lot of words. It has no meaning. It's a sound. Like if I was Chinese, I would say aya, aya. If I was Korean, I would say aigo. If I was Japanese,
I think any
I would
poker players heard that a lot of times.
Huh? Yeah.
I think any poker players heard a whole lot of ayas at the table.
But you got to know the level of the aya. You know, it could mean aya, I got dealt two aces. You know, I can't, you know, I got 7-2. I got 7 deuce. So, I mean, you have to learn, you know, because tone is so important to us. Our ears are very receptive to that tone. And it's a thing to be investigated, you know, watch when sit at the table, the kind of sounds that people make. And I think that's what's been my, that's what saved me a lot in my work. So, I mean, you can tell when people are vulnerable when they start talking, you know, when you start hearing the sounds that come out of their mouth. You might not understand the words, but you can hear the level of vulnerability. So,
I was going to say, you've probably also had specifically voice training and things like that as part of your course of study to become an actor, and I imagine that only sensitized you to all these things even more.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've studied dialects. I've studied languages. I studied opera, you know, which was very, very important to me, because then you have to study, you know, European languages: Italian, French, German. And you understand the basis of thought when you understand those languages. You know, because first comes a thought, then comes a language. And in poker, it's the same thing. You know, the thought comes first, and then the language comes.
Right. And once you feel like your acting career helps you to interpret, or your study of acting helps you to interpret, I guess, like what your opponents are thinking and feeling based on what they're saying and doing?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not, you know, my poker, I'm not, you know, I belong to a poker site, you know, I belong to Poker X Factor. I'm a longtime member of that. And I read all the material, and it's very scientific, you know, what's plus EV and, you know, going. And but basically my background is reading people, because you could have all that knowledge, but I think when you're playing live, reading people is part of the game as well. And I think that's my forte, you know, is reading people and deceiving people as an actor.
So you're able to do that as well? Like if, you know, for instance, you're slow playing and you're trying to act weak, you're thinking about probably a lot of things that other poker players aren't, in terms of the way your body is moving and the tone of your voice or something like that?
Yes. And how I'm being, my image as well. And what image do I want to convey? Do I want to be a rabbit? Do I want to be a wolf? Do I want to be a dragon? Do I want to be a rat? You know, I'm always thinking, it comes natural to me. It comes natural to me. But then there are guys like, I don't know if I told you, I did Curb Your Enthusiasm. Now, I know you've seen that show.
I certainly have. Yeah.
Even if you don't have HBO. Have you seen that show?
Yeah, a little bit. Not as much as I'd like to, but a little bit, yeah.
Okay, and where you have guys like Larry David, who is like, he was, you know, I go to the set and Larry is like, okay, his guys come up to me and they go, okay, look, you don't talk directly to Larry. Larry talks to us. We talk to you. If you have anything to say to Larry, you don't go to Larry. You go to us, and we'll discuss it with Larry. And so, you know, that show is totally improvisational. Mm-hmm. And so I get on the set. Larry tells his guys what he wants with the scene. Those guys come up to me, and they tell me. And he's standing like 4 feet away from me. I mean, you know, I've worked with some of the best in the business, you know. I kind of thought this was very strange, you know. So it went on for a little bit, and finally I turned to Larry. I said, Larry, you know, these are my words. Am I going to get paid for writing this stuff? Just to bust his balls, you know. And he just like looks at the two guys like, didn't you tell him the deal? And I went, and then he looks at me, and he's horrified. And but however, we got on really well after that, because I think Larry, you know, having been with Seinfeld for all those years, was like, you know, it was like everybody wanted to put the bite on him, if you know what I mean. He's become a very powerful man in the industry, and I'm sure everybody he meets wants something from him. You know, that's why he doesn't really like to talk to people. And I met several people like that, you know, in the industry. So, I mean, there's all kinds of crazy people, you know. I've done most of the talking. You guys want to ask me something? You guys want to ask? You guys, like, disagree. We haven't even talked about, you know, my political period. So...
All right, well, so where does that come in?
Well, like I said, you know, I joined this group of that it was kind of like in the ghetto, you know, this inner city cultural center, doing right after the Watts riots. And
Early 90s?
No. This is like the 70s. 70s.
Oh, those Watts 80s. Riots. Okay. I was thinking, yeah. After
Rodney King? No.
Yeah, okay. Right.
So this was in the 70s, at the real Watts riots. Yeah. Okay. I was we had the draft then, and I was 1A, and I was told to report to my draft board. And I refused to go. I said I would not go to Asia and to go there and kill another Asian guy. For what reason, I didn't know. So I got politicized then. And I started working in the Asian American community, working with other young men like me, and working with returning Asian American veterans who had gone to Asia and had fought there. And I worked in the Asian community, and I started helped building the first Asian American theater company in America. And that was the East West Players, and started wanting to develop Asian American performing art and writing. And consequently, I got into a lot of political things, and so I had a really, you know. I lived with Jane Fonda for 3 months in Paris, you know, while attending the conferences there and the peace talks. I'm just saying that is a part of me too, you know, if you want to know me.
And I guess this was a safer time to be political in Hollywood than, say, during the 1950s.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. But still yet, you know, we were governed in California, and a lot of our unions were still really right wing. You know, our president was Charlton Heston at the time, mm-hmm. of the Screen Actors Guild,
right.
And we were fighting on different fronts there, you know, to liberate ourselves, because from that period of the 50s, you know, during that, are you now or have you ever been? You know, a communist. We're trying to liberate ourselves from that as well.
So, I mean, did you feel like you got there was any blowback to your career from your being so heavily involved in, like, anti-war politics?
Maybe, but Hollywood, you know, Hollywood is really strange in terms of, like, they don't care. As long as you make them money, that's all they care about. You know, and making them money is like making the ship go smoothly. And I was very keenly aware of that. I was very able to function within that capacity, you know.
Meaning, like, you know, you showed up, you knew your lines, you were reliable, you were, you know, had a good reputation that helped you to get more work.
Right. I was solid, you know. And I also had a somewhat of a personality, you know.
That's not surprising to me.
So anyway, I don't know, any questions? I hesitated to come on because I didn't know how I could help your reader, your listeners. I don't know if I could interest them in any way.
Yeah, I mean, the show is about people in poker and how poker plays a part in the lives of a lot of different people, and, you know, helps them lead better lives, or is just an interesting part of interesting people's lives. So it's fascinating to hear how you think poker made you a better person, and how your craft of acting and how the game of poker work together. Like, right now I'm a computational biologist, and I think that there aren't quite so many connections between computational biology and poker, and it's it's really cool to hear that your craft and your hobby sort of fit together in that nice way.
Yeah. I've been able to break a lot of barriers with poker. I can tell you that, you know, I've had poker games and I remember playing poker. I went up to do Streets of San Francisco with Michael Douglas and Carl Malden. And we had a poker game on the set. Carl and Michael didn't play, but a lot of the guys did, you know. And I was able to establish some kind of, how would you say, some kind of self, you know, an identity, yeah, by being able to play, you know. I mean, somebody took me seriously.
Is that a pretty common thing on set to have a poker game?
When you're on location, yeah. Or if you have a group of guys, they like to get together and play poker. I play live with a group of Hollywood people, a bunch of mostly like agents, camera people, technicians. Yeah, I play sometimes live games with them. Yeah.
Has it gotten easier for you over the course of your career? I mean, I know when you mentioned when you were first getting started in the industry, a lot of people were telling you there's just no place for an Asian American actor at all. I mean, how do you feel like opportunities have changed?
Well, I think that with our political work, we changed it because we fought on every level. When Kung Fu was being done with David Carradine, we fought them. We got certain gangs. We got them to hire some of our people. You know, I don't even remember if David Carradine got hired as Kane, the lead character in it.
Yeah, I wasn't aware that there was a controversy around that, although there was a big surprise fight.
There was a big fight. They tried to redo Charlie Chan with Ross Martin. I don't know if you know, remember Ross Martin. Ross Martin was the sidekick on the Wild Wild West. I don't know if you remember that series with Robert Conrad. But he was a character actor, and he was a white guy, and they wanted him to do Charlie Chan. Well, we had a big political fight over that, and we've been fighting ever since. And part of our fight is developed was to train Asian American artists, because what you can't substitute something bad with, you can't say you need to hire an Asian American if there are no good Asian Americans. You need Asian American directors. You need Asian American writers. Well, that's what we did. Our work was to develop them. But know this. I get a lot of work because I knew the streets too. You know, I was, like I said, a lumpen proletariat, I knew how to go in and con people into making me think I was something that I was not. So I have that skill too.
Well, I mean, when you were at the beginning of your career and so many people are telling you there's no role for Asian Americans, it sounds like that was relatively true at the time. I mean, there weren't a lot on television or in the movies. What made you stick with it rather than just saying like, well, you know, I'm never going to find work. I need to go do something else.
It's all I wanted to do. It's something I could not do. I wanted to be a performer. I wanted to be an actor. And I wanted to be the best. You know, if there was, you know, at least I wanted to be the best Asian American actor. And I tell you, even today, you know, as I go on the set of like the Sons of Anarchy, it's a battle. Because I go in and they're expecting one thing, and I have to show them another thing.
What are they expecting?
Well, it's like if you sat down at a table with Doyle Brunson, Phil Ivey, Daniel Negreanu, Anthony Esfandiari, and you go there and you say, I can play two guys, you know?
I see.
Don't consider me any less than you. And that's what you constantly have to do in Hollywood. You get on the set and you have to, you have to gain that kind of status immediately. Otherwise, you just become a punk or a fish, And so you have to have that kind of skin. You have to develop that kind of skin. If you don't, you're not going to make it. That's why a lot of people will say, don't become an actor. Don't become, somebody. If your son came up to you, Andrew, and said, I want to become a poker pro, what would you say?
It's not as easy as it sounds.
It's not an easy, no, don't. There are so many other options that you have that makes much more sense. Only do it if you cannot not do it. And that was me. And I'll tell you, when I first came out, I was 18, 19 when I got my first job. My first job was on a show called Room 222. And I was very fortunate because of the Watts riots, the networks were trying to include minorities in the show. This was about a classroom. And they had to have some faces of color. Well, I was able to get in, and I just was a deer in the headlights. And I realized, boy, I have to learn. I have to get better, I did the first Bill Cosby show, too. Not the Bill Cosby show, but the first show that Cosby ever did. He was Chet Kincaid, the gym instructor, and I was able to latch onto being one of his students. And it was because, you know, I had a good mouth. You know, I grew up on the streets. I had talked to a lot of swabbies and sailors, you know, and I could make them empathize or sympathize, even worse, you know, sympathize with me. And I would get work that way. But I realized at the core that I needed to develop a lot better. You know, and the same way with poker. You know, I was beating a lot of kids in school, but I realized later, which my two friends helped me realize, there's a lot of things I had to learn about poker before I could really ever play poker. I mean, I've just been so fortunate because of my life as an actor, and also because my life as a poker player. You know, can I tell you one of my greatest poker stories?
Please.
I was at the World Series of Poker one year, and I couldn't win a thing. I just couldn't do anything. I was walking down the hall, and this lady steps out and goes, "Hey, do you want to enter our drawing?" And I was like, you know, really bad. I said, no. I said, what is it for? She goes, a poker seat. And I thought she meant a table with seats, you know. I said, lady, what would I do with a poker table in my house? I don't need one. She goes, no, you don't understand. It's a seat. I went, what are you talking about? And she said, well, it's for Caesars. And I said, this is the World Series of Poker. We're at the Rio. What is it? I said, okay. So I put my name in. A couple months later, I got an email saying, hey, you want a seat in our $10,000 tournament? I went, what? I said, I never played for that kind of money before. $10,000? An entry into your, what do they call? I don't know. It's a Caesars, the big one. Anyway, and $1 million guaranteed first prize. And I went, and we start off with something like $100,000 in chips. I said, I wouldn't know what to do. I said, are you sure it's me? So I go, they say, yeah, it's September and you come. And so I called up some people and I read Card Player magazine and I hired this guy, Barry, what's his last name? The guy who passed away is a card player author.
Barry Shulman?
Barry Shulman, yeah. I call him up, he goes, I charge $200 an hour. I call him up. I said, well, I need some coaching. I'm going to enter into this $10,000 tournament. And he goes, well, don't play your aces and queens like seven and deuces, 7-2. And I meet him in Vegas. And he gives me a little run through. And he goes, listen, he says, if you want to be there for the second day, just never bet. You know, if you just want to make it to the second day, if you want to get it to the past the second day, you got to do some betting. If you want to get in the money, you have to take some chances. Don't play your ace queen like a seven deuce. And that's it. That was the lesson. $200.
Andrew would have been better, I think.
Yeah. He says, well, he said, if you ever get premium cards, bet it. And I did. And, I made it to the third day. I was in the money, and I was so happy. I don't know how I did it. I was sitting across Johnny Chan, Scotty Nguyen, Phil Hellmuth, and they were looking at me like, who is this guy? Because all I kept thinking was, if you got a good hand, bet it. And I would just shove. You know, it wouldn't matter. I would just, if I got a pair of queens, I would just shove. And I finally got in the money, and I busted after I got into the money because I was so relieved after playing for 3 days for 12 hours a day. I was like a wet rat. and I won 18,000, which was kind of a nice little score, you know.
Yeah.
And
considering all you had to do was fill out a piece of paper.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, that's one of my poker stories anyway. But consequently, since then, I had built up a little bankroll, and I was able to play further on down the line. And I really thank those two guys, CPO and poker player for life who really mentored me. I don't know what the deal is with me, but people always want to mentor me. I don't know why, because I was like, I was really not a good person, you know. But maybe they saw something that was important. And you know what a good friend told me? A good friend helped me once. It was David Milch, actually, the guy who created Deadwood. He helped me a lot during a bad period in my life. And I said, David, how could I ever repay you? He said, you know what? He says, the only way you can repay me is if you turn around and you help somebody else. And I kind of try and live by that concept, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a good one.
Yeah. And so, you know, I know poker is about exploiting and taking down fish and beating up donkeys. But, you know, I think there's, for me, it's myself. It's challenging myself. Yeah.
Well, thanks. We should probably, you've been very generous with us, and you've stayed on our show for a long time. So
I know how shows work, and maybe you can get 10 minutes out of it.
I think more likely we're going to have to see what the reaction is like, and we might be asking you to do this again sometime. But
All right, guys.
Well, thank you so much again. Really, we really appreciate it. And sorry for any audio problems I had, but have a great evening.
I hope that I know Andrew and I are friends, kind of, because, you know, we've kind of like met. And I hope that you and I can become friends too, Nate.
I hope so too. It's really been a pleasure, and I'll see you in comment threads, and
You need to see Deadwood. That's what you need to do.
Yeah, you need to see Deadwood, dude, because I mean, there's some good writing. You really appreciate it.
Yeah, I will definitely do that, and I'll be in touch.
Okay.
Have a good
Anytime.
Evening.
Anytime. Bye. Tapping on my window pane. Devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you want.